Desafinado, Discord, the theme music for Literary Discord, the WPKN program on books and book publishing. I'm Hans Koning. This time we want to be even more different. We don't want to talk about money, and we do want to talk about the mess we are in, country-wise. We have heard a lot on this program about committed versus uncommitted literature, meaning that literature which has a hidden message is committed, and novels which just want to entertain. Art for art's sake, and message literature. A writer or a painter or any other artist is supposed to float high above the daily struggles of humanity. Walter Goodman warned us that this is of the essence if we prize our artistic freedom. An old Atlantic Monthly editor once said that a black novel, quote-unquote, could never be true art because by its very nature it was protest writing. In my idea, it is just the other way around. All worthwhile writing is protest writing of one sort or the other. If nothing is protested, then it is committed to that very uninspiring cause, the status quo. It is not the subject which makes a novel committed. It is committed if the writer shows that she or he have gone through an awareness of the human comedy or drama. They may choose the simplest subject, but they must show that awareness of having gone through that. But that awareness I'm talking about must be hidden. If it's too obvious, you don't have a novel but a piece of propaganda or a lecture, and you very quickly lose your readers. Trollope is a fine example of having a hidden message and being a pleasant novelist, entertaining at the same time. He was the one who said, the message has to be hidden like a snake in the grass, but if a novel has no message, it is not worth reading. Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, Brecht, the poet Garcia Lorca, all writers who have written about writing have said the same thing in different words. Lorca, just before he was executed by the Franco soldiers, said, the idea of art for art's sake would be cruel if fortunately it weren't so ridiculous, so impossible. Cruel may seem an odd, strong word, but if you think of the writer working away in his attic or in his air-conditioned penthouse, ignoring the misery and the violence of the world around him, then the word cruel is very fitting. And right now, these past few weeks, there has actually been a change in the role writing plays. For the first time in American history, I think, war has been protested not halfway through, not because of large casualties, but it has been protested before it had begun. Writers, I would think the vast majority of them, have come out against the Iraq war. And because the time was so short, because every day or hour lost seemed tragic, it is poetry which has found a new role here. Novels, economic essays, political essays are dealing with it. But in this new century, where we set out with an appointed president, a feeling of urgency has taken hold of most of us. The direct emotional appeal of poetry has a power of a different sort from novels or political essays. It is immediate, and we memorize lines without even trying. That's why this Literary Discord program is different. Who wants to hold forth about publishing while this nation is at war? It is devoted to poetry and obviously to peace poetry. Mrs. Bush was singularly wrong and misdirected when she imagined that American poetry this spring of the year 2003 would be about sunsets and birdsong and not about the war. It seems appropriate to have some of these poems banned from the White House read in this program, WPKN's Literary Discord. If not here, where? I'm not a good public reader, and I have lost my voice, and I have a Dutch accent, and for all these reasons and others, we have here a woman who is herself a poet, a New England poet, and an actress, Kate Finley, to read our poems. Kate, will you begin?
This first poem is called The Issues by Sharon Olds. It's about Rhodesia in 1978, but it says a lot about war. The Issues. Just don't tell me about the issues. I can see the pale spider-belly head of the newborn who lies on the lawn, the web of veins at the surface of her scalp, her skin gray and gleaming, the clean line of the bayonet down the center of her chest. I see her mother's face, beaten and beaten into the shape of a plant, a cactus with gray spines and broad, dark maroon blooms. I see her arms stretched out across her baby, wrist resting, heavily, still, across the tiny ribs. Don't speak to me about politics. I've got eyes, man. And the next one is by Sam Hamill, who in fact started the whole Poets Against the War by being invited by Laura Bush to the White House for the Symposium on Poetry and the American Voice. And he sent out an email to all the poets that he knew across the country asking them to write poetry against the war. And as a result, Laura Bush canceled the symposium. But it started a whole thing on the internet of the Poets Against the War. And anyway, this was his poem, State of the Union, 2003, by Sam Hamill. I have not been to Jerusalem, but Shirley talks about the bombs. I have no God, but have seen the children praying for it to stop. They pray to different gods. The news is all old news again, repeated like a bad habit. Cheap tobacco, the social lie. The children have seen so much death that death means nothing to them now. They wait in line for bread. They wait in line for water. Their eyes are black moons reflecting emptiness. We've seen them a thousand times. Soon the president will speak. He will have something to say about bombs and freedom and our way of life. I will turn off the TV. I always do, because I can't bear to look at the monuments in his eyes. The next is New Hampshire, February 7th, 2003, written by Maxine Cumin, who was also one of the poets against the war. New Hampshire, February 2003. It's snowing again, all day reruns of the blizzard of 78, newscasters vying for bragging rights about how it was to go hungry after they'd thumped the vending machines empty. The weatherman clomping 4 miles on snowshoes to get his mic so he could explain how 3 lows could collide to create a lineup of isobars. Footage of state troopers peering into the caked windows of cars backed up for white miles on the interstate. But nowhere, reruns of the bombings in Vietnam. 2 million civilians blown apart, most of them children under 16. Children always the least able to dive for cover when all the tonnage bursts from a blind sky. Snow here is waiting the pine trees while we wait for the worst, for war to begin. Schools closed. How the children love a benign blizzard, a downhill scrimmage of tubes and sleds. But who remembers the blizzard that burst on those other children? Back then we called it collateral damage. We will again. This is a poem called The Low Road by Marge Piercy, which was read by Howard Zinn in New York at the first demonstration against the war by a group called Not in Our Name, in September, I think. The Low Road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. But how can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they'll roll over you. But 2 people fighting, back to back, can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. 2 people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. 3 people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With 4, you can play bridge and start an organization. With 6, you can run a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. 12 make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000 your own media, 10 million your own country. It goes on, one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day, you mean one more. This is a poem by Philip Booth called Narrow Road on President's Day. It's not about war per se, but I think it says how people are feeling in the country right now. Narrow Road on President's Day. As I drive by the architect's house, his wife is just opening up the side yard window and leaning out, on her elbows, to talk to three backyard sheep. She smells spring, given sun trying to break through dawn fog, fog after all-night rain on top of 2 months of old snow. She gives herself gasps of light. Not a mile back, just beyond Harmon's farm stand, all boarded up against winter, almost at that new place where they sell Russian tractors, I sniffed skunk first time this year. Had to swerve my pickup to keep from sideswiping a skunk already dead, and next to him, for Christ's sake, a big mother porcupine dying hard. I kept on driving to work. I keep on now, holiday or no. My whole morning messed up by roadkill, wannabe presidents, street bombs, cyberspace, Bosnia, and what's to become of the former United States of America. America only once divisible. Half blinded by free-flow tears and new sun, I find myself still touched by that woman talking with sheep, and I try to figure out what they are saying to each other, and when, if spring happens, the new lambs will come. And this is one of my own poems, called The News is Bad. The news is bad. Talk of force, good and evil, secret and revealed. These are men, mostly, talking of Saracens, clanging for war, feet strapped in leather, a heartbeat drumming them and us, them and us. What treacherous roads around abyss and gate we turn and twist to feign our fate, leaving mothers and waifs mute under a blackened sky. This is a poem by Eleanor Wilner called Found in the Free Library. And we were made afraid, and being afraid, we made him bigger than he was, a little man and ignorant, wrapped like a vase of glass in bubble wrap all his life, who never felt a single lurch or bump, carried over the rough surface of our lives like the spoiled children of the sultans of old in sedan chairs. On the backs of slaves, the gold curtains on the chair pulled shut against the dust and shit of the road on which the people walked, over whose heads he rode no more aware than a wave that rattles pebbles on a beach. And being afraid, we forgot to notice who pulled his golden strings, how their banks overflowed while the public coffers emptied, how they stole our pensions, poured their smoke into our lungs, how they beat our plowshares into swords, sold power to the lords of oil, closed their fists to crush the children of Iraq, took the future from our failing grasp into their hordes, ignored our votes, broke our treaties with the world, and when our hungry children cried, the doctors drugged them so they wouldn't fuss, and prison swelled enormously to hold the desperate sons and daughters of the poor. To us they just said, war, and war, and war. And when they saw we were afraid, how knowingly they played on every fear, so conned we scarcely saw their scorn, hardly noticed as they took our funds, our rights, and tapped our phones, turned back our clocks, and then to quell dissent, they sent... But here, the document is torn.
You are listening to Literary Discord, the WPKN program on books, the future of the novel, and tonight, poetry. I'm Hans Koning. Our reader is Kate Finley.
Notes on the Capitalist Persuasion by John Haynes. Everything is connected to everything, So runs the executive saw, cutting both ways on the theme of all improvement. Your string is my string when I pull it my way. In my detachment is your dependency. In your small and backward nation, some minor wealth still beckons. Was it lumber, gas, or only sugar? Thus, by imperial logic, with carefully aimed negotiation, my increase is your poverty. When the mortgage payments falter, then in fair market exchange, your account is my account. Your savings become my bonus, your home my house to sell. In my approval is your dispossession. Often in distress, all social bonds are broken. Your wife then may be my wife, your children my dependents, if I want them. So too our intellectual custom. Your ideas are my ideas when I choose to take them. Your book is my book, your title mine to steal, your poem mine to publish. In my acclaim is your remaindering. Suppose I sit in an oval office. The public polls are sliding, and to prove I am still in command, I begin a distant war. Then, in obedience to reciprocal fate, by which everything is connected, my war is your war, my adventure your misfortune. As when the dead come home, and we are still connected, my truce is your surrender, my triumph your despair. This is a poem called Complaint and Petition by Haydn Carruth. Mr. President, on a clear cold morning I address you from a remote margin of your dominion in plain style Yankee quatrains, because I don't know your exalted language of power. I'm thankful for that. This is a complaint and petition sent to you in the long-held right I claim as a citizen. To recapitulate your wrongdoings is unnecessary. The topic is large and prominent, and already occupies the attention of historians and political scholars, whose findings will in the near future expose your incontinent and maniacal ambition for all to see. So let it suffice to say that you have warped the law and flouted the will and wisdom of the people as no other has before you. You have behaved precisely as a tin-pot tyrant in any benighted, inglorious corner of the earth, and now you are deviously and corruptly manipulating events in order to create a war. Let us speak plainly. You wish to murder millions, as you yourself have said, to appease your fury. We oppose such an agenda. We, the people, artists, artisans, builders, makers, honest American men and women, especially the poets, for whom I dare to speak. We say, desist, resign, hide yourself in your own shame, lest otherwise the evil you have loosed will destroy everything, and love will quit the world. This is a poem called Occupation by Eliza Griswold, which ran in a recent New Yorker. The prostitutes in Kabul tap their feet beneath their faded burqas in the heat. For bread or 15 cents they'll take a man to bed. Their husband's dead, their 7 kids unfed, and thanks to occupation, rents have risen 20-fold. Their chickens, pots, and carpets have been sold, and woman's flesh now is worth its weight in tin. 2 years ago, the Talibs favored boys and left the girls alone. A woman then was worth her weight in stone. Another poem by John Haynes, The Last Election. Suppose there are no returns, and the candidates one by one drop off in the polls. As the voters turn away, each to his inner persuasion. The front runners, the dark horses, begin to look elsewhere, and even the president admits he has nothing new to say. It is best to be silent now. No more conventions, no donors, no more hats in the ring, no ghost-written speeches, no promises we always knew were never meant to be kept. And something like the truth, or what we knew by that name, that for which no corporate sponsor was ever offered, takes hold in the public mind. Each subdued and thoughtful citizen closes his door, turns off the news. He opens a book, speaks quietly to his children, and begins to live once more. This is by Denise Levertov, called Making Peace. A voice from the dark called out, "The poets must give us imagination of peace, to oust the intense, familiar imagination of disaster. Peace, not only the absence of war." But peace, like a poem, is not there ahead of itself. It can't be imagined before it's made. It can't be known except in the words of its making. Grammar of justice, syntax of mutual aid. A feeling towards it, dimly sensing a rhythm, is all we have until we begin to utter its metaphors, learning them as we speak. A line of peace might appear if we restructured the sentence our lives are making, revoked its reaffirmation of profit and power, questioned our needs, allowed long pauses. And a cadence of peace might balance its weight on that different fulcrum. Peace, a presence, an energy field more intense than war, might pulse then, stanza by stanza, into the world. Each act of living, one of its words, each word a vibration of light, facets of the forming crystal. Letter to a Fellow Activist by Alfred Korn. Loyal, I think, to this nation, I hereby inculpate myself for making slapdash, insufficient, and tardy efforts to save it from the brutal, disastrous, avoidable brink our misguided executive and Congress have brought us to. Demonstrations, petitions, and reasoning seldom make an impression on heat-packing chauvinists. They don't give a flying whatever, bent as they are on showing the world who's in charge. The practice of politics, always beyond belief boring, will take care of us if we fail to take care of it. Despair is suburban. So we soldier on, casting our ballots for candidates who won't be elected. We write those who were. We canvass and organize. No, in all honesty, I can't, at the age of 60, pretend I would welcome being clubbed or imprisoned. But I do root for those nonviolent actions performed in the interest of liberty, justice, and peace. For Americans, sure, but as well for all people everywhere. To save the skin of one Arab, Israeli, or Yank, would I write an obvious poem? You bet I would. If only it could save. When gauging results of our deeds, I take an agnostic approach. Seek justice. The aftermath is not in our hands. Since all wars are boyish, would that all war criminals, present and future, grow up and not dream it's cool or effective to pistol-whip erstwhile allies they've turned into enemies. Should one ever resort to violent measures in the name of a righteous cause? I would say not. Aren't we a global concern? The Blue Planet's symbiotic affiliates? Yes. Because no man or nation is an island entire of itself. If the bell should toll for Iraq or for Palestine, it will toll for these states and Israel too. For the threatened ideals of fair play and loveliness embodied in poems we are moved to live by. PFC Korn here, reporting for Peace Watch. This is a poem called Poem for the End of the Century, also by John Haynes. I am the dreamer who remains when all the dreams are gone, scattered by the millennial winds and sacked by the roadside. The solar clock hand stopped, confusion and fury on the street, so much idle paper shredded and tossed aside. The small, dim shops of the tourist trade are shuttered and locked. Nightfall, and the buyer turns away. One more stolen fortune spent, another century gone with its fits and desolations. I leave my house to the creditor wind. Tell me if you know my name, whose face I wear, whose stored-up anger fades to a tentative smile. I am the one who touches fire, who rakes the leaves to watch them burn, and who says once more to himself on this calm evening of earth, "Awake! The stars are out, mist is on the water, and tomorrow the sun will return."
Listen to Literary Discord, the book program of WPKN Radio and syndicated other radio stations. WPKN broadcasts Literary Discord on the second Tuesday of each month at 9:30 in the evening and on the fourth Thursday of each month at 12 noon. Other stations have their own schedules. I am Hans Koning. The poems were read by Kate Finley. Our producer, as always, was Scott Harris.